content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today we'll be reading from Volume 63, Number 1, It's Revolutionary Prelude to War. And we'll begin with Different Declarations, How Everyday Americans Decided on Independence by Michael Henzinger. Michael Henzinger worked for many years as a classroom teacher. His love for history inspired him to join the Museum of the American Revolution in 2019. Henzinger trains the museum's educators and gets to work with teachers and students while designing educational experiences and resources about the American Revolution. Many people have heard of the Declaration of Independence, the document that established the United States of America. But have you ever wondered if you would have supported independence at the time it was written? How did everyday people make up their mind about such a momentous choice? Do you think that it was a difficult thing to decide what to do? It can be easy to overlook the experiences of ordinary people when looking back on historical events like American independence. But putting ourselves in the shoes of the people who lived through these events can help us understand them better. Those living in British North America in the years leading up to independence witnessed or experienced a great deal of change and turmoil. Various laws passed by Parliament triggered resistance from British colonists in North America. This resistance ranged from written protests and legal petitions to boycotts of British goods and acts of violence. Local acts of protest and resistance fed a larger movement set on restoring the liberties that many felt they had been deprived of by King George III and British Parliament. Despite this resistance, most of these colonists had not desired independence. Even when Massachusetts Minutemen fired on British soldiers at Concord Bridge and Bunker Hill, they believed they were fighting for their British liberties rather than a new nation. This changed when King George III declared that the colonies were in a state of treasonous rebellion. Colonists had to consider if they should give up their struggle or if a new way forward was possible. The idea of forming a new nation that was independent from Great Britain had not been seriously considered by many Americans, but that began to change in 1776. American views on independence were shaped by their disappointment with their formerly beloved king and an emerging idea that monarchs were unnecessary or even dangerous. One of the key pamphlets in this growing argument was Common Sense, written by Thomas Paine and published in January 1776. Pamphlets in the American colonies were printed publications from 5 to 48 pages that covered just about any topic, from weather to farming to politics. Paine's style of writing was straightforward and a bit rowdy, which turned out to be an effective tool for rallying people to the idea of independence. He argued that there were flaws in the British constitutional monarchy, which is a system of government in which both a monarch, a king or a queen, and a legislative body or parliament share the power of ruling a country. He argued there were flaws that held the colonists back and would continue to restrict their liberties. Paine suggested Americans reject monarchy entirely and replace it with new forms of representative government that would be more capable of protecting the liberties that Americans valued. Paine also suggested that colonists should not expect to defeat the British Empire to preserve their liberties without assistance of foreign allies like France and Spain, who would only become involved if the colonies declared themselves independent. Presented with arguments like these, people throughout British North America began to consider if they wanted an independence. Delegates representing many of the British colonies in North America convened the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, to debate the best path forward. Meanwhile, more and more people also began to speak out on independence. Their opinions varied and were shaped by many factors. Some hoped that rejecting a monarchy through independence would create opportunities for the abolition of slavery and a push for greater universal human rights. Abigail Adams was one such person. She once wrote, "It always appeared a most iniquitous scheme to me to fight ourselves for what we are daily robbing and plundering from those who have as good a right to freedom as we have." She lived in Massachusetts near the front lines of the growing war in North America and was familiar with the consequences of resisting the British Empire. Destruction of tea by protesting colonists in Boston had resulted in retaliation from British Parliament. Boston's port had been shut down, the Massachusetts government had been replaced with a military governor, and British troops continued to occupy the city of Boston. She even witnessed fighting between American militia and the British Army. When Abigail's husband, John Adams, left to join Congress, she wrote to him saying, "I long to hear that you have declared an independency." She also called on him to support women's rights in the new code of laws that the country would have to make after independence. Not all colonists witnessed such dramatic events as Abigail, but their personal experiences and circumstances still led some to support independence. Louis Thiebaud lived in New York and made his living as an artisan, which is a person skilled in making things with their hands, such as furniture, quilts, or other crafts. He also belonged to a group of craftsmen called the Committee of Mechanics in Union. Together, they came to believe that King George III had ruled with an iron hand and that the economic impact of British policy had become intolerable. On May 29, 1776, Thiebaud and his fellow Union members issued a declaration to the New York legislature stating their support for independence from Great Britain. They were not alone in doing so. Throughout the American colonies, many others had made their voices heard during the spring and summer of 1776. In South Carolina, Judge William Henry Drayton effectively declared the independence of that state by instructing a grand jury that it could decide cases without royal authority. A grand jury is a jury that examines the case of a person accused of a crime to see if a formal charge should be made. Several battalions of associators, militia groups, from Pennsylvania voted to support independence as well over the course of June. Amidst these declarations, many more were made by representatives from towns and counties in Massachusetts, New York, Maryland, and Virginia. They voted to support independence and urged their colonial governments to do so. Support for independence was expressed in many ways and in many places throughout the American colonies as Congress gathered support for the idea and began preparing its own vote on the matter. Yet not everyone in North America supported the movement for independence. Just as people had different reasons for supporting independence, there were many reasons why some chose to instead lend their support to the British. Mary Perth, an enslaved Virginian, saw an opportunity to seek freedom by fleeing to the British Army. The royal governor of Virginia had attempted to disrupt the resistance to British authority by offering freedom to enslaved people in Virginia who agreed to fight for his government and whose enslavers had supported the rebels. Though Mary Perth was actually enslaved to a loyalist, she saw Dunmore's proclamation as the best way to find freedom amidst the American Revolution. For Joseph Brant, a leader of the Mohawk Indian Nation, American calls to independence threatened his people's very existence. He worried that revolutionary Americans would expand westward and force his people from their lands. He met with King George III in 1775 and was convinced the king would protect his people. Others, like Hannah Griffiths, a Philadelphia Quaker, opposed independence because she distrusted anyone who called for violence. She thought that Thomas Paine was a snake beneath the grass. Griffiths believed that independence would turn American colonists against each other. Most Americans remember that Congress officially declared independence from Great Britain in July of 1776. What they often forget is that many Americans were uncertain about what the future held for them. Would the revolution succeed, or would the rebellious colonies return to British control? What consequences would they face for personal choices they made to support or oppose the revolution? When we put ourselves in the shoes of everyday people and ask questions like these, we end up understanding our history in brand new ways. To learn more, explore the Season of Independence Interactive at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia at amrevmuseum.org/interactives/season-of-independence. Here's a think about it sidebar. Who's not pictured? Today with our smartphones, we can easily snap hundreds of selfies and other photos and share them around the world. But during the American Revolution, portraits were rare. Usually only the wealthy could afford them. Look through this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian, which covers the mid-1760s through 1776. Who do you see? Who's missing? How can historians help these other voices be heard and seen? Here are the captions for the article's images. Portrait of Joseph Brant by George Romney, 1776, painted while Brant was visiting England. Portrait of Abigail Smith Adams by Gilbert Stuart, circa 1800. She became First Lady when her husband John Adams was elected as the second President of the United States in 1797. Mary Perth left enslavement behind and traveled to Freetown, Sierra Leone, in search of freedom. Print showing exterior view of Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, as it looked in 1776, circa 1873. A modern image of Independence Hall. Common Sense, addressed to the inhabitants of America on the following interesting subjects by Thomas Paine, was a 47-page pamphlet that called for independence from Great Britain. Also, the author, Thomas Paine. Next, They Held the Quill by Sally Causey Bloom. Sally Causey Bloom writes, deletes, and writes some more on topics in history for the North Carolina Museum of History, where she also produces videos and live streaming events. You did it, William, Joseph, and John. You just signed the Declaration of Independence. And what made you take up the quill? And what's next? Signing the Declaration of Independence on North Carolina's behalf began in other colonies. William Hooper, born in 1742, died 1790, was born and educated in Boston, Massachusetts. Joseph Hughes, born 1730, died 1779, was born and educated in Princeton, New Jersey. And John Penn, born 1741, died 1788, was born and grew up near Port Royal, Virginia. Have you ever moved to another town, state, or school? Well, so did William, Joseph, and John. They relocated to North Carolina, where it was easier to get ahead, to make money and become involved in the community. They participated in local politics and were elected to North Carolina's provincial congresses. Hughes, Hooper, and Penn were also enslavers. While they spent much of their time thinking, writing, speaking, and working toward liberties and freedoms, their understanding of liberty did not extend to the people they and many other patriots held in bondage. And none of them woke up one morning thinking, I have an idea, let's declare independence and fight a war. Mostly they woke up, had breakfast, and hoped for reconciliation with Britain. William Hooper. William Hooper settled in Wilmington in the 1760s, where he practiced law. He was elected to the North Carolina Assembly in 1773. This was the council advising royal governor Josiah Martin. Hooper worked to defeat a proposed courts bill that he believed limited colonial rights. Governor Martin punished Hooper by keeping him from lawyering for a year. So when a committee of correspondents formed to coordinate with other colonies, Hooper agreed to participate. And his responsibilities as a speaker, writer, and thinker kept him busy as he participated in North Carolina's provincial congresses, the first Continental Congress, and yes, the one with that major piece of parchment, the Second Continental Congress. In April 1774, in a letter to James Iredell, Hooper wrote that the colonies are striding fast to independence, and ere long will build an empire upon the ruins of Great Britain, will adopt a constitution purged of its impurities, and from an experience of its defects will guard against those evils which have wasted its vigor and brought it to an untimely end. In other words, the colonies would be like Britain, but better. Despite the letter, Hooper officially sought a middle ground. He hoped for reconciliation with guaranteed rights for the colonies. By 1776, however, he knew Britain would not be making any compromises. The king announced that the colonies were in open rebellion was a big hint. Must not every man, a friend of the cause, and every capable of duty, turn out with his musket, he wrote. Joseph Hughes. Joseph Hughes also believed that reconciliation with guarantees of colonial rights was the best path forward, until it wasn't. In 1755, Hughes moved to Edenton, where he started a trading partnership. Hughes became wealthy and looked to participate in civic efforts. He was elected to the assembly, working with Royal Governor Martin, where he served on all the committees having to do with money. Like Hooper, Hughes joined the Committee of Correspondence, and he also was elected to attend the First Continental Congress. There, he realized that not all the colonies had the same ideas, sort of like today. Some colonies advocated for defending colonial rights with force, while others were supportive of a lot of parliamentary control. Still, by 1776, Hughes could no longer postpone open support for independence. I have furnished myself with a good musket and bayonet, and when I can no longer be useful in council, I shall be willing to take to the field, he wrote. John Penn. John Penn moved to North Carolina later in the colonial period, in 1774, after practicing law in Caroline County, Virginia. The Penn family moved to Granville County, which was part of the colony's backcountry. And backcountry interests did not always line up with those of the eastern part of the colony, represented by Hooper and Hughes. In 1775, Penn was elected to the colony's Third Provincial Congress, and that group, seeking a way to help unify the colony, elected him as a representative to the Second Continental Congress. While Penn disagreed with Hooper and Hughes on many political issues, he agreed that reconciliation with guarantees of liberties with England was for the best. Once certain that compromise was unattainable, Penn called for other countries to support the colonies' war efforts through trade, which he knew would lead to total separation with Britain. The vote for independence. On July 2, 1776, Virginian Richard Henry Lee made a motion in Congress that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. Hooper and Hughes voted aye. Penn and Hughes voted aye. Hooper, still traveling from North Carolina, missed the vote. In August, all three took up the quill and signed the Declaration of Independence. And then work continued. What was left? The men focused on winning a war, governing a new state, and having input on what would come next. Hughes helped start the new Continental Navy. He brought John Paul Jones, who became one of the first naval heroes of the United States, on board. Hooper served in North Carolina's General Assembly. Penn remained in Congress for more than 1,000 days, serving on multiple committees. When British forces threatened North Carolina, Penn served on the state's war board, organizing supplies for militia troops to defend the state. All three men died in their late 40s, their health failing early. Hughes died before the war ended. Penn passed before North Carolina ratified the U.S. Constitution, and Hooper died soon after. Their quills at rest, their signatures remain, marking North Carolina's support of independence. There's a photograph of the Declaration and with a caption, "The Declaration of Independence is about 24 by 30 inches in size. Can you find the signatures of North Carolinians Hooper, Hughes, and Penn?" And on the next page, it shows a highlight that says, "Did you find them? This close-up of the Declaration of Independence shows the spot where the delegates from North Carolina pick up the quill and signed." William Hooper, Joseph Hughes, and John Penn signed the Declaration of Independence on behalf of North Carolina. What do you see when you look at their images? Do you think they knew how momentous this document would become? And there's also an object description, inkstand, circa 1750 to 1830. Where do you put your quill? In an inkstand. This inkstand dates to sometime between 1750 and 1830 and includes spaces for ink, quills, or a pen, and sand. Not actual sand, but pounce, which was a fine powder sometimes made from bone that was sprinkled on wet ink to dry it. Next, from the editor, what do you think? Have you ever heard the expression, "the pen is mightier than the sword"? What do you think? How could that be true? Wouldn't a sword, like the Scottish broadsword pictured in this issue, be able to chop a pen in two or smash it? Well, yes, physically that's true. But let's think deeper about this, what expression might mean. Of course, the story of the American Revolution involved both pens and swords and other weapons. But let's think about the stories we've read in this issue about people who fought during these times with their pens as a different kind of weapon. They used their pens to focus their ideas into words, words that called people to action. Some used pens to write down song lyrics. Some drew political cartoons. We read about Thomas Paine, who was a political activist, philosopher, and revolutionary. He wrote Common Sense, a pamphlet with only 47 pages that helped inspire American patriots throughout the colonies to declare independence from Great Britain. And of course, there was the Declaration of Independence, the founding document of the new United States. It declared to the world that these 13 colonies, including North Carolina, were no longer subject to British rule. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The cool thing about the pen or modern computer is that it allows us to exercise our First Amendment right to free speech. As a child, you used a crayon to scribble all over a piece of paper to say, "Look what I wrote. I'm here. This is me." You can use a computer to write a stirring essay to turn into your English teacher, or to enter into the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine article contest. You can use a paintbrush to create a mural that tells the world what you think and believe in brilliant colors. Or you can curl up alone in your room and declare your thoughts and ideas to yourself in your private journal. The most powerful things about history are not the dates and names and events we memorize to get a good grade on a test. The real power lies in the pen, the tool we use to tell the world what we think, the tool we use to record history. What declarations would you like to make? How will you use a pen or a computer to write down your ideas, your story, or your truth? We hope this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian will inspire you to use your mighty pen to become a part of history. Kathy East, editor. There's a photograph with a caption, "Phyllis Wheatley, circa 1753 to 1784, was a black writer who voiced her opposition to slavery through poetry. Born in West Africa, she was captured by slave traders when she was around 7 years old and brought to Boston, Massachusetts. She was sold to John and Susanna Wheatley, who educated her and taught her to read and write. In 1773, she published poems on various subjects, religious and moral, and became well known in both England and America as the first African American to publish a book of poetry. Soon after, she was freed from slavery. Wheatley wrote poems about many subjects, including George Washington, child mortality, her fellow black artists, and her experiences as an enslaved woman in America. It's revolutionary. What is freedom? On Boston Common in Massachusetts, the Sons of Liberty met under a 100-year-old elm tree to plant protests against British rule. Soon, patriots in other colonies designed Liberty trees. In 1775, British supporters acknowledged the Boston tree's importance by cutting it down. The last original Liberty tree, a 400-year-old tulip poplar in Annapolis, Maryland, fell during Hurricane Floyd in 1999. Its seedlings continue the Liberty Tree legacy, including one planted in Charlotte's Freedom Park. What is freedom is a question that still resonates. Well, what is It's Revolutionary? Well, this magazine is part of it, as are an upcoming educator notebook, videos, a history in a box kit, and more. All resources and programs to bring history to life for you, educators, and families in North Carolina and beyond, as we explore our revolutionary past during the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. Who is its revolutionary? We hope that you are part of this exploration, too. Did the articles in this issue help you understand what life was like for people who lived here in the years leading up to the Revolution? Can you better experience how difficult it was for some people to know whether to support the conflicting positions of the period or not? And how others believed that they had few options at all? Do the artifact images make you want to explore the stuff of your own history? What things, writings, media posts, or places speak to your story and your choices? We hope It's Revolutionary helps you see that the past not only affects our todays and tomorrows, but you are making history too. Explore all of the It's Revolutionary projects, some in place and others coming soon, at BTE250.com. That's BTE250.com. We are grateful to the North Carolina Society of the Cincinnati for their support of the North Carolina Museum History Foundation for It's Revolutionary. And here's a heads up to let you know that in the next episode, we'll be starting the Spring 2024 issue, which continues It's Revolutionary with Choices in Conflict, Volume 63, Number 2 of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.